Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hey guys, what's up? Welcome to episode 59 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. My name is Brian Sippets. Thank you so much for joining us. Today we have Scotty Livingston, whom I met at Perform Better in Chicago. Listened to an awesome presentation about breathing, which is surprisingly way more exciting than it sounds, actually. So I got a chance to meet Scotty there. We got a chance to talk today about his role as an NHL strength coach from 2008 to 2010, and then what he sees the evolution as the NHL strength coach to be, and where he sees it going in the future. So really an interesting conversation. We also talked about his presentation at Perform Better, which was harnessing the power of breathing, basically about how breath and breathing can unlock potential that we didn't know that we had. So super interesting stuff there. Before we get going with Scotty, take a look at the website. We've put a bunch of new articles up recently. Devin McConnell added a single leg adjustable height squat video. Anthony Renna just posted a couple of videos, one at my place at Advantage Strength and one at USA Hockey at Daryl's place. So check those out. Some good Strength Coach TV episodes there. I also posted a new article, Kid Sports Turned Pro. It's just in the Time magazine, a little bit of a scary stat, or some scary stats, including, you know, how much kids' parents are spending on sports and kind of figuring out what our role is there. So check that stuff out. Brand new articles up on the site. It's HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. Remember, you can join us for just a buck for the first 7 days if you haven't been a member yet. After that, we know you're going to want to stay on board with us, so check it out. It's just $14.95 a month, or you can get 2 months for free if you join for the year. So check it out. In the meantime, let's get going with former NHL strength coach and now serial entrepreneur Scotty Livingston. All right, hey guys, today we have on the phone Scotty Livingston. Scott is a guy that we met, or that I met at Perform Better in Chicago. Had a really interesting performance on breathing. Did I say performance? I guess I meant presentation. Presentation on breathing. It was quite a performance, yeah. So he's the he's the founder of High Performance Inc., which is now Premier Performance. He also describes himself as a professional entrepreneur, which we should touch on here, Scotty, and a reconditioning specialist, which I think we'll touch on more. So, Scotty, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So you do a lot of things. You know, when we met, I wasn't quite sure how much you actually had your hands in, but, you know, as we do a little more research and as I learn a little bit more about you, there's a lot going on, and including, I think, what drew me to you, especially for this podcast, was your history of time in the NHL. So you started off with the Islanders in, was it
1998.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me a little bit about your time in the NHL and how you ended up in that position.
Well, I spent time in the NHL with three different teams. I started in 98 for 1 year with the New York Islanders, then I was 2 years for the New York Rangers, and then I came back to my so-called hometown of Montreal, Canada, and worked for the Montreal Canadiens until 2009. And my role was as an athletic therapist in the States, referred to as an athletic trainer and a strength conditioning coach. So I'm a dual practice professional. And that was my role while I was in the National Hockey League. Prior to coming into the National Hockey League, I'd worked at a university in Canada in the same role and function for taking care of the varsity athletes at a school called Concordia University. And I basically got certified in both professions back in the late 80s and had been working in that role for a while, and then got an opportunity to go into the National Hockey League and took it, and then stayed there for a while. And while I was in the National Hockey League, I also got involved in some side work start to build a personal business where people could access me when I wasn't with the team. That was called High Performance. And that business was grew up inside of another business called Premier Studio, and eventually we merged it and called it Premier Performance. And so it's basically a hybrid between a clinical sort of paradigm and a training performance paradigm, a very personalized one-on-one type of training environment. And essentially, when I was in the business of – well, I've been in the business of sport all my life, and I've served lots of different roles, which I'm sure we'll get into in the podcast. But essentially, the combination of the two professions, therapy and strength and conditioning, was sort of what I specialized in, and that was rebuilding athletes who were broken and fixing problems that athletes had had for a long time, and then also training them for performance. So that was – that's been my – life work, so to speak, or practice.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's kind of been the way the profession has gone, or I guess the position, especially in the NHL. How have you seen, you know, were you in that role when you started in the NHL, and then how have you seen the position of strength coach change as the years have gone on, and each and every team now has, you know, a team of specialists?
Well, I guess if you look at it from a North American sports culture perspective, the idea of a strength coach really was created out of the genesis of the NCAA back in the 60s and 70s, and then you started to see strength coaches in pro football in the States. In Canada, much later sort of genesis of that professional. We don't have as robust varsity athletics at university level. And so in the universities in Canada, it really started to happen in, I would say, the late 80s, early 90s. I was actually one of the first people ever hired at a university in Canada as a strength coach. But that it had had an existence. The NSCA, I think, started or was founded back in the earlier mid-60s. And so, you know, it was around. And so the NHL started to sort of pay attention to it. I would say the life creation of it was in the early 80s. The Team Canada was getting squashed by the Russians, and everybody wondered why, and they figured out that it was had something to do with their fitness. So then you started to see this physiologists getting hired by a lot of teams, and so their focus was a lot on aerobic profiles of athletes. And then in the early 90s, when they sort of started to discover the concept of strength conditioning, that became a little bit more of a real practitioner as a you'd seen it born out of the NCAA and the NFL. A lot of NHL teams started to hire guys. And so I ended up being sort of, I would say, at the front of that curve of the NHL hiring people. And it's funny, the first job I got with the Islanders, the reason I got the job was I was the only guy of 16 guys who got hired that were interviewed that could skate. So early in sort of the National Hockey League history, a lot of times they would hire guys who had worked for football teams or worked in college athletics in the States and didn't really understand the game of hockey. One of the more famous guys that now obviously you know who was a little bit prior to me in the NHL was Mike Boyle. And Mike had started with the Bruins and done a bunch of work with the Bruins. And so he was one of those, you know, the early grandfathers, along with a guy named Pete Twist, who's out in BC, who had been with Vancouver. So these guys were guys who had kind of started the world in the NHL in the early 90s, and I kind of got in the back of that wave and then kind of grew up in it. The changes, it's changed dramatically over time. As I said, in the 80s, it was probably very founded on aerobic capacity. Then you got into strength training, but the strength training was more, I would say, founded around the same conceptual model that it trained for football players. And really, as we're seeing now, a football player's training isn't really very much the same as a hockey player's training. They're different kinds of animals. In the beginning, that really wasn't understood, and so you saw a lot of hockey players blowing groins and tearing abs because they were just almost too strong for the game. And so that's changed over time, and now you see a lot of specialists in conditioning who really know the game of hockey, who've played the game of hockey, who worked the game of hockey, and now I think you're starting to see guys get really trained well for the game of hockey. And that's kind of happened from the time at which I sort of was beginning to retire till now.
Cool. So and your role now is primarily on the reconditioning side. And that's, I think, where a lot of your breathing stuff came from for that presentation. But you know, and I've spoken with Bill Knowles before about the idea of reconditioning. What does reconditioning mean to you, and how is it different from maybe, I don't know, some other areas, strength and conditioning, that kind of stuff?
For me, reconditioning is really taking the strength of expertise or the knowledge paradigm of therapeutic practice and integrating it with the knowledge paradigm of conditioning practice and creating something that you take the strengths of both worlds and you really are able to create maybe a better practice in some sense. And that's not to undermine the practice of strength conditioning or the practice of therapy, but both worlds have tended to be sort of silo-oriented in the way they grew and developed and had certain methodologies or approaches that were a little bit myopic to some degree. And so the strength and conditioning world became very focused on what I would call capacity, making somebody stronger, fitter, faster, more powerful. And the therapeutic community sort of focused on the reactive management of injury. What I had started to see way back in the 90s when I first started professionally, and I was influenced by lots of different people that I had bounced into, like Gray Cook and other people, was the sense that the therapists knew some things and learned some things about how to look at a body that the strength conditioning practitioner didn't learn. And at the same time, the strength conditioning practitioner learned a lot of things about exercise and movement that the therapeutic practitioner didn't learn. So what I wanted to do is take the value proposition of those two worlds and put them together so that both could be much more powerful and both worlds could talk to each other better, more respectfully, empathize with each other, and see where each other's strengths could help an athlete be that much more successful.
Do you still like what you're seeing in terms of, you know, the high performance team where everybody, I mean, everybody has a role and everybody is a specialist in their very own thing, but I feel like now in the NHL, they're forming these high performance teams where it is still specialized and the approach is integrated, but it's because of the cooperation of specialists rather than one person who's integrating to the approach. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's still, I guess, in the early genesis of this is still the weakness of the strategy, is that what you've seen in terms of integrated practice in most environments has been the assemblage of sort of an interdisciplinary team, whether that's sports psych, nutrition, strength conditioning, therapy, put them all in a box and then either have somebody lead it or it sort of self-leads. And the weakness of that is you're still asking people to speak a certain language to try to speak to one another. And so not unlike having somebody from China, somebody from America, somebody from France, somebody from Germany all come in a room and try to have a conversation with one another. You know, if they have some very limited broken English, you might get some communication, but you're not going to get, you know, a real robust communication. And so ultimately, you either need somebody at the head of the table who speaks most languages, or everybody has to learn a little bit more of everybody else's language. And I think what you're going to start to see over the next probably 10 to 20 years is that refabrication where people become that much more cognizant of what each other does, and that you see the leaders be people who are more hybrid-oriented practitioners who've done a lot of different things, including potentially being an entrepreneur or being somebody who has led groups, integrated groups, brought people together for a common purpose or practice.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and it would be nice for entrepreneurs to have a position in that field or in that future. Let's talk a little bit about that. How, you know, you describe yourself as a professional entrepreneur, and so, you know, obviously you've got a business going there. How does entrepreneurship factor into what you do?
Well, I think an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't get stuck in a box of this is my job or this is my role. An entrepreneur is forced to experiment to see a lot of different thought processes, understand where their strengths and weaknesses lie, bring practitioners or people from whatever or consultants in to service different needs that they might have, recognize where their weaknesses are and strengthen them by having other people in that space, and try to find a way to really lead a group of people who are going to help them build a business or whatever it is they're doing. And that tends to be something that's a weakness in a lot of organizational structures, whether that's a team environment or I've seen this in high performance sport, is you get people who've learned to be really good at being what they are, whether that's a surgeon, a strength coach, a therapist, a sports psych, a coach. They're good at what they do, but they don't necessarily have that, I guess, entrepreneurial mind where they can look outside the box, see where the holes are, see how they can bring them together. And so what you end up doing is you end up having programs with some very high quality people who don't really work together very well. And so that's what's always interested me, and what I guess inspired me about getting into business was learning how to really challenge myself in that way. And it allows me to look at some problems and create solutions that maybe are a little bit different than the norm or different than what would normally be done.
I see. So for you, entrepreneurship doesn't necessarily mean business. It's just a matter of, you know, taking advantage of opportunities or exploiting opportunities that are available to you.
Yeah, I think it's a characterization of people. I mean, you can build a business, but if you're an entrepreneurial spirit within the construct of an organization, again, you're not limited by the box that we tend in society to put people in. And so I'm always kind of exposing myself to, you know, new thought processes or different thought processes, and allowing myself to maybe challenge to be something haven't been necessarily put in. Like now I'm expressing myself as somebody who I'm getting more and more interested in performance culture, in what helps people perform to their best, in mindset, in how you become a better person, how you work with other people in a better way. And so that has nothing to do with being a strength coach or a therapist, but it has a lot to do with being, I think, ultimately successful and happily successful at what you do.
Yeah, and, I mean, this is an area that I'm kind of more interested in, I guess, because I have a business, you know, a physical brick and mortar type place. But I think, you know, what you've said is almost, it almost goes against what you hear about businesses, because as a business, you want to have a face, you want to be known as a certain something. Like you can be the hockey guy or the reconditioning guy. Do you find that people are oftentimes wondering what it is that you actually do, you know, in your business?
Probably not at this point in my life. I mean, I'm, you know, I've done 30 years as an S&C AT, and I've trained, you know, athletes at the very highest levels. And most people, if you ask them, you know, what does Scott Livingston do, they'd probably say, you know, some version of he's a accomplished strength coach, an accomplished therapist. He does reconditioning. He worked with Olympic athletes, whatever their label would be on me. I think there's a difference between what people externally label you as and what you label yourself as. And I have tried not to in later parts of my life label myself so much as this is what I am versus who I am and who I want to express. And so I could have gone on, and probably one of the reasons I left the National Hockey League was because I didn't really want to be boxed into that label of being the Canadian strength coach, you know, for the rest of my life. I wanted to sort of explore. And not everybody's the same. Some people love what they do in that genre, and they express it very well, and they're impassioned by it, and I certainly was. I was not a hockey guy per se. I'm a sports guy. I like helping athletes or any human perform to their greatest potential. So whether I was doing it in hockey or was doing it in football or was doing it in soccer or whatever really didn't matter to me.
I see. Yeah, I guess I'm 5 years into this and you're 30 years into this. So you have an established brand behind you. So
yeah, it makes a difference for sure. But at the end of the day, you know what? You have to sort of start to, and this is something I am always talking to people about too, is establish who you are, and you can establish who you want to be known for, what you want to be known for. But I don't think that those two things need to be limiting. They just need to be challenging. So they're what you want to be good at that time in your life, and you're going to express yourself in that, and you want to build a business framework around that. But if you get limited by it, what ends up happening is, unless you're deeply impassioned by it, and some people are, you will find yourself someday being sort of very constrained by it. So the idea is to be, you know, yeah, from a business platform and building a business and making people aware of what your service is, you got to build a brand. You've got to build a sensitivity of what it is that you're delivering. But don't be constrained by it. Don't make it delimit who you can be. You can be anything you want to be, so to speak. But in the time that you're right now, your business is what you want to do. Then make a name for yourself in that. And that doesn't count for you. It counts for anybody, so to speak.
Yeah. So. Well, that's awesome, because I think, you know, we do have a lot of young coaches that listen to the podcast here, and any young professional, really. You don't even have to have a business, but anytime you're establishing yourself in any industry, whether it's, you know, you're an American League strength coach and you're looking to be an NHL strength coach, you know, it is important to have that toolkit and be proficient there. But at the same time, you're going to have other interests too. So,
Absolutely.
So I wanted to touch a little bit on your presentation from Perform Better in Chicago, and this is probably like the tiniest bit of what you actually do, but you were talking about breathing and, you know, how it affects function, how it affects performance, and I just found it really interesting. I mean, obviously there's a lot of information out there about mechanics and things like that, but it's amazing how much breathing really affects, from posture to performance. So I guess I'm not even sure where you would want to start with it, because it is such a huge, huge topic, but talk a little bit about what your presentation was about and the points that you wanted to get across.
Well, I would say it's funny, and I don't mean this derogatorily in any way, shape, or form, but it's funny that you would say it's amazing that it has that much of an effect, because I think most people would react that way. But I think it's amazing that we don't think it has that much of an effect. I mean, fundamentally, if we stop breathing, we die. So it's fundamentally the most important thing that we do to stay alive on this earth every day. It's what provides our body the necessary fuel for us to function. If we are low on O2, a lot of things start going on in our body that is not a very good situation. That and water, and then general nutrition, are the three most important things that we provide to our body on a daily basis in order for us to function on this earth. And it's funny how we tend to pay them limited to no mind. There's been a lot of energy, I think, in the last number of years put more into nutrition, but also a lot of miscommunication around it and misunderstanding around it. And I'm not truthfully sure we'll ever really completely understand nutrition, because at the end of the day, nutrition is very much a individually dependent reality. Each body manages and manifests differently the nutritional substrates that go in our body. But at the end of the day, every human being needs oxygen. Every human being manages and deals with oxygen to be able to function on a daily basis. So getting that oxygen into your body is paramount. And then when you look at how breathing affects our parasympathetic system and our sympathetic system, and how we can up ratchet and down ratchet just based on using our you know, respiration rate, we can ratchet up through breathing mechanisms, and we can ratchet down through breathing mechanisms. So we can impact our state of energy, our state of mind, simply by how we breathe. So I think it's an extremely important thing. And as I've gone into more and more of the therapy side of stuff, I see the links to how it sets our body up and how we function more and more. So, you know, that's kind of my viewpoint on it.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, before I wouldn't mean to say like it's shocking that it does that much, but I think people usually stop at yes or no. Are you breathing? Yes. Good. Let's move on.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
So
you're alive? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So but what you're saying is something that you mentioned in your presentation was that, you know, it's poor movement, or you know, does poor movement or poor habits lead to the poor breathing patterns, or do poor breathing patterns lead to that, you know, postural issues and things like that? Touch on that a little bit, and how you've helped somebody in the past who has come in with, you know, one or the other, and then kind of opening them up. And
yeah, well, again, they're kind of chicken and egg related. I mean, if your posture is not good, if you think of your trunk as a can, and if that can has a nice flat top and a flat bottom, that can has all of its available space in order to intake fluid, in the same way that your respiratory system has all of its available capacity to intake oxygen. As soon as it's bent or dented or changed in terms of structure, that fluid capacity in the can is reduced. It's the same thing with your body. So your posture changes that actual capacity. It also tends to infer a certain amount of restriction. So if I'm really flexed or I'm really extended, my muscles don't necessarily work as efficiently as they would be if they were more at a neutral sort of state of affairs. So lengthened muscles or shortened muscles don't function as well as muscles that are in their mid-range, and that's where we get our greatest force production. So when we get our system stacked properly from a postural perspective, the respiratory system, the diaphragm, the muscles in the rib cage all work much more efficiently and effectively to actually produce respiration. So the posture side of things affects the quality of respiration. On the other side, if we have poor respiration, then that can change muscle dynamics. It can change and create more stiffness in tissue because we're not getting enough O2 into the muscle. So the actual quality of the muscle tissue diminishes, and so therefore the quality of the inspiration and respiration diminishes. So by actually just changing our respiration, we actually change the physiology of our body quite dramatically, and that's what we're really looking for. And then, you know, there's some things that you aren't necessarily proven in the literature yet by through study, but ultimately what I have seen professionally is as you improve breathing, because it is so interconnected with posture and function, the better we have posture, the better we have breathing, the more freely things start to move. So we have we can impact mobility, we can impact stability and strength more effectively when we have a good center point from which we're working, and our trunk is our center point. People like to call it the core or what have you, but really it is the trunk, and the trunk is kind of the center point for the connectivity between our upper limb and our lower limb and all the other things that we do. So if our respiration, we sort of treat it as our center point, and we start there and make sure that's good quality, then we're starting with a good footing. It's kind of like if you're going to start to climb up a wall, you don't start necessarily by putting all your body on the wall. You start to make sure your ropes are strong and set. If the ropes are not strong and set, not going to be a great climb. So we want the breathing to be strong and set.
That's great. So, you know, I imagine that in Montreal there, and given your background, you're seeing a lot of hockey players. What do we see? You know, are there any common themes, common threads that run through the hockey community that's different maybe from other athletics?
Well, hockey players in general tend to uptake what we sort of call, it's a generalization. It's not necessarily true of all
for
athletes,
sure.
But
sure.
They'll uptake what we kind of commonly refer to as a scissor posture, which is that the rib cage becomes a little bit forward and extended, and the pelvis becomes a little bit anteriorly dumped. So if you think about looking at somebody, the front of their body is sort of not in a in a belly forward position, but we've got sort of this lengthened tissue at the front and this tightened tissue in the back and the rector spinae group and the muscles of the back. And so we don't have that can that has even sides. We have a can that has a lengthened side and a shortened side. To some degree, there's an efficiency associated with that in the sense that if the pelvis is forward, our glutes function a little bit more powerfully. We can produce a great skating stride. We can be a little bit more erect in our posture from the perspective of managing the puck. And so we get into that posture because that may be a little bit more effective for, you know, what we do on the ice. So the big problem is not so much the posture that the athlete holds in the ice. The big problem is that can they get out of that posture? Do they have the available quality to be able to get into that canned position? And it's always a problem when we can't create that availability or we don't have it, if we're stuck there. If we're stuck there, then we're limited. When we're limited, we have no choice. So the whole idea of the concept of reconditioning or working on breathing or working on these things is, can we create the availability? Can the athlete or person get into that position? Does that availability exist? Yes, good, thumbs up. If they get on the ice and they're back into a bit of a scissor posture because that's what they need to play the game, fine. But we don't want them stuck there. That's the key.
And so then, again, obviously this is a huge generalization, and I'm sure there's a lot of practices that go along with this, but what are some common things that you might do in order to see if somebody has that range, for one, and sort of try to create it, for two?
Well, first of all, I look at posture, and as you saw in the workshop, we did sort of a quick uptake on that and how the person is in a standing posture. But, you know, standing posture can be sometimes a little bit deceiving. You know, standing is not what we always do in a hockey player. They're going to be in a position to skate on skates, etc. So we're going to look at their posture when they're on their hockey skates and in their skating position. So I want to look at posture dynamically. How does it affect it when the person changes or moves? And then I also want to look at how they breathe. So we're going to look qualitatively at how they breathe in different positions, lying, seated, standing, in their hockey position, etc. And how does that change? So, as an example, you might have somebody lying on the table breathes very effectively, but when they stand up and get into their hockey position, they don't breathe effectively. And so that is a problem, because when do they need to be breathing effectively? When their respiratory rate has to increase because physiological demand increases. So, you know, you want to make sure that they have an efficient and effective breathing capability when they're going to really need it, especially. So I look at it in a whole bunch of different ways. And then, if it's not working, we sit down and figure out the process that we're going to go through, whether that's going back to the basics or whether that's working. You know, if they've got the basics but they don't do it well in the strategic position, then we have to connect the awareness. So ultimately, a lot of times people aren't aware of where they are. You give them some awareness, they connect with that awareness, and you give them some work to work on connecting with it, and all of a sudden, once they become connected to it, then they can find it and be in it when they need to be. And then it's all about that availability.
So let's talk about, you know, just to wrap up here, let's talk about what coaches or people that work with hockey players, or really anybody, what should we be looking for in terms of a breath? I mean, I think if you told a room full of people to take a big, deep breath, you'd probably see some things that you didn't really want to see in a breath. So talk a little bit what a ideal breath looks like and how we should be trying to get that with our athletes.
Well, again, so that I don't confuse people too much, we want to establish a question to start from. So, you know, what is their posture look like, and can they get into a better posture in order to produce quality breath? They can't get into that posture. In other words, we've got this scissor positioned person, and to try to get them to just calm down and set up is almost impossible. then, you know, that's going to be problem solving one. If I'm looking at just the breath alone and what I want to see, I'd like to be seeing a connection between the rib cage and the abdominal wall. I'd like to see them sort of happening at the same time. Some people are purely abdominal breathers. Some are purely rib breathers. Ultimately, we in shallow or normal breathing, it tends to be predominant or should be more predominantly abdominal, but the rib cage shouldn't be completely shut down and rigid. So there should be sort of an acquisition from both parts, a sort of a connectivity between both parts. Oftentimes you'll see a disconnect. Ribs will be doing one thing and abdominal wall be doing something else. And then we want to see a 360 degree observation of breath, meaning that the breath comes into the back, front, sides at the same time versus it all comes out through the tummy at the front, or it all comes out through the rib cage at the front, which is what we often see. Or somebody who has real respiratory problems, you're going to start to see the neck get involved, and we see that with more in an older population of people who have, you know, certain respiratory issues because of smoking or what have you. But that's what I want to see is nice 360 quality connection between the ribs and abdominal wall and a relatively good postural setup.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, as the scissor guy, I am the scissor guy. you know, it's like I lay down on the floor, and unless I'm actively working on it, you can, you know, fit a couple matchbox cars under my low back, drive them right through. So, yeah, and I find that if I do get into that, you know, get out of that scissor posture where I bring my pelvis back into alignment and lower my ribs a little bit, I notice that if I take a deep breath, especially a belly breath, I find that like my scalenes light right up. Like, so right up in here, I get like a pulling and a tugging. So I know I'm not there, in terms of that, but it's difficult. It's hard to get out of the position that you're in. You know, in the 360 breath doesn't happen for me at all. I'm a total belly breather, and I have a lot of trouble getting it into my back. So I'm there with you for sure. But yeah, and then it's just about, you know, maybe bringing some awareness to that and
yeah, and ultimately it's about, you know, in any growth and development process, it's about process, not perfection. I'm not looking for somebody to be the perfect breather day one or even a day 50. The goal is really, can we improve it over time, and can we get off? I like to describe to people when I'm talking to clients that we tend to walk around in life a little bit like when we learned how to drive a car. We learned how to drive when we were told that we needed to keep a certain number of car lengths between us and the car in front of us. And what happens over time because of injuries, posture, different kinds of things, stresses, etc. in our life, we start driving with the bumper of our car and the bumper of the car in front of us. And so then when something happens, we have no buffer. And that's when we get into injury, we get into sickness, etc. So what we're trying to do by breathing more qualitatively, not perfectly, but more qualitatively, is gain car lengths. So this is never really about you looking at the person you're working with and saying you have to be the perfect breather. But if for example, you can be maybe a few degrees less in extension, maybe a little bit more into the abdominal wall, maybe a little bit more aware of your breathing, you're now, instead of driving on the car in front of you's bumper, you're two car lengths away. You might not get five or six car lengths. We don't need perfect. What we need is better.
Oh, that's a great way to put that. Well, I think we'll wrap up with that, but it definitely really interesting stuff. Is there... do you have any resources? Do you have any way to get in touch with you if people want to learn more?
Absolutely. They can check my wife and I out at reconditioninghq.com. And I'm on Facebook and always happy to have people connect with me. I'm also on LinkedIn. People connect with me. I'm always trying to produce some impact out there in various ways. So happy to learn from others and to help others grow. We're teaching courses all the time in reconditioning, all over, hopefully, North America as it grows. So hopefully if there's somebody out there that wants to connect with us, they can find us on our website.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much, Scotty, and we appreciate your time, and keep up the good work.
My pleasure, Brian. Nice meeting you online again.
All right.
right, guys, that wraps up episode 59 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Thanks to Scotty Livingston for joining us. One thing we did not talk about on the show, I just wanted to share, if you want to connect with him on Twitter, it's @BuiltByScott. It's @BuiltByScott on Twitter. And then on Instagram, it's King O'Payne, KingOPain. So both pretty active feeds there. So interesting stuff. Check them out. And what a great conversation today. Hope you enjoyed it, guys. Until next time, be sure to train smart and check out HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com, the world's greatest resource for training hockey players. We'll talk to you soon, guys.